gigabyte, kilobyte, terabyte, megabyte, all this stuff makes my brain mega hurts. Fortunately, someone is available to explain all this technobabble. Translating technobabble to English, your translation expert, Benjamin Rockwell, is here with Computer Talk Radio.
Tons in store for you this week here on Computer Talk Radio. Steve Keskin and I are going to talk about what chatbots are. Dr. Doreen Galley is going to cover the SEMA Automotive Expo. Keith Emcedor and I are going to talk about touch screens on Macs, and that's after some Apple pundits have been discussing the whole idea of touch screens there. Mark, do we really want smart everything? And on the Scam Series, I'm going to give you an idea about using casual questions to weed out scammers. I also have a number of listener questions. Randy asks, why should people with no experience be paid lots of money? That'll be on the IT Pro series. Aaron asks, performance of video conferencing software suffers at times. And I give a boatload of different reasons why that could be. Lily, she asks if she should be worried about data breaches from retailers. And Sylvina, why does my software license key not work after a RAM upgrade? All of that on this week's Computer Talk Radio. Of course, the website, computertalkradio.com. And you can catch the podcast there just in case you missed any of those different items that you were possibly interested in. You can also reach out to us there at the website, or you can phone me at 888-NERD-888. That's 888-6373 for any of your computer questions or technology concerns. Let's dive into the news. And the Chinese manufacturer DJI has been battling an issue regarding the sale and lawful usage in the United States. There's a lot of a battle that's going on there and has been for way too long. A number of different government legal attacks are serving up continuing concern for them. And we have talked about the Federal Aviation Administration and their concern in the past. Now, the Federal Communications Commission has jumped on this bandwagon, and they've changed some requirements and can now retroactively ban items that could be a security risk. This comes under the category of, quote, radio frequency devices, end quote. And if the FCC wishes to, they could not only ban future sale, but even, yes, retroactively downright ban all of DJI's drones due to this issue. Now, DJI has to fill out some new paperwork to prevent being added to a ban list, but this seems to be a building set of hurdles for them. I will note that DJI occupies about 80% of the drone market in the United States, and their absence would leave very few options. Now, Amazon, they've got an interesting new update to Fire TV operating system. And this is including a new feature that really promises to be amazing. We're still at just the very start of this. And I haven't checked it out or anything like that for myself yet. But the new offering across their devices is a merged watch list from your various services. So if you've got something on Netflix, Amazon Prime, Apple TV, or a number of others, it'll actually show up on the homepage. And there's a lot of integration that they're working on so that they can be the one-stop shop for you when you load up the Fire TV OS. And then you will see the various movies and series and all of that. And this has an integration that's actually going to be building. They're looking to show films or series that you started perhaps on Netflix and now it's moved elsewhere, like Amazon Prime. This feature is something that may help with keeping our eyes glued to the screen, but also find something that we may have partially started and still want to finish. You may need to update your TV or Fire Stick, but this is here now for anyone running Fire OS 6. Now, Perplexity is a newer AI company, and they've come out with their own AI web browser, and it's called Comet. Apparently, however, they've been creating a little bit of consternation for Amazon and how they access Amazon's own website. We're referring to Amazon.com, where you would buy things. And this has led to a lawsuit that accuses Perplexity of accessing customer accounts and disguising the automated activity as human browsing. Amazon insists that the usage of this AI agent degrades the customer shopping experience, while Perplexity has been calling Amazon a bully, using legal threats and intimidation while stifling innovation. Of course, wouldn't you know it, Amazon is also developing similar tools already, and yes, clearly, they don't want to have any competitors. This is only the start of this particular journey. This one lawsuit will probably take many years to sort out, and things will have changed along the way between now and whenever we get to the end of this big, huge battle. Now, I will note that neither Google nor Apple have confirmed this, so this could be part of a rumor mill, and it may not be a done deal, but as much as we've been hearing about Apple Intelligence, it's interesting that Apple is reportedly looking at Google's Gemini product to get a leg up on that space for Siri. Now, they've been promising updates to Siri for quite a while, and AI is a tough space, and the folks that arrive late are going to have problems, and Apple was one of them. So it makes sense that they would work out a deal to somehow move ahead at this point, to kind of catch up and maybe even put themselves at the top of the list. Now, this may cost Apple another $1 billion a year, but on the flip side, Google already pays Apple $20 billion to be the default search engine on Apple devices. Now, well, these are big numbers to most of us. I would say all of us. It's actually not that big for Apple, of course. Apple just reached past the $4 trillion market cap point just recently, and Google isn't that far behind, at about $3.5 trillion. So to them, both of them, these are actually kind of small numbers. Now, when we think of space stations, most of us think of science fiction. We think of like Deep Space Nine, or in the real world, the International Space Station, aka ISS. The Tiangong is China's own space station and has been orbiting the Earth since April 2021 without much concern. This week, however, it was announced that three of their astronauts are going to have to hang out for a little while longer than their planned six-month visit. The Shenzhou 20 was slated for return on November 5th, but it appears to have been struck by some space debris or perhaps some kind of meteorite or something like that. And they're having to figure out the safety of usage and possible options from there. There are backup plans, however, including a mission that's on standby to send a new capsule up for them and return them that way. So we're going to have to wait and see how this all rolls out. I will note, I don't speak Chinese, so please forgive me for any mispronunciations of any of those terms, those names that I just said out. Now, space, of course, is the final frontier. And when I say that, space, the final frontier, something probably pops into your mind, the idea of Star Trek. What doesn't typically pop into your mind is Lego. And both have been fascinating for nerds and geeks. This week, Lego announced a galactic-sized merging of both of those fan bases. The Star Trek Next Generation Enterprise D is now available as a 3,600-piece set, complete with 9 minifigs representing very key crew members. Yes, Picard, Riker, Guinan, and even Data. including his little cat Spot. So this is actually really cool, and there is a lot to take in, and it's going to include a lot of what you might expect if you're a fan of Star Trek The Next Generation. They include a couple of shuttle bays, which conveniently slip into a little... or I should say shuttles that slip into the shuttle bay, but also the search section actually separates just like it does in the movie. This is going to be available right at Thanksgiving, a few weeks away, so make note if you know someone who this would be perfect for. Now, coming up next, yes, we're going to talk cars. Yes, Dr. Jareen Galley went to the SEMA Automotive Expo, and with the way cars have been evolving over recent years... there's a good reason why we're going to be talking about that here on Computer Talk Radio.
Let's talk about on and off.
You mean like light switches?
Yeah, the original user interface device.
And you were there, right?
Hey, I'm not that old.
Yeah, you are. So on and off.
Yeah, only with no humans doing it, like...
But you and I both have our computers on CyberPower UPS systems.
Yeah, so we have power, but there's another on and off.
Oh, right. Online and offline.
You got it. Meaning another UPS at the cable modem and VoIP phone and Wi-Fi router.
And even a low-cost standby UPS can handle those. Better, of course, if it has AVR.
Right, so it doesn't have to hit the battery just because the line voltage drops.
Maybe it's a good time to mention the promo that saves $10 to $15. Details are at the CyberPower website.
And maybe you could put it on your website?
Oh, that's already done at ComputerTalkRadio.com.
You know, on and off, you take really good care of your listeners.
The website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. That is just one way that you can reach out to us. Scroll down to where it says contact us today. We will answer your computer questions, your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Dr. Doreen Galley joins me, and Doreen, you just went to SEMA, which is a huge show about cars. Now, 20 years ago, we'd be going, why are we going to talk about cars on Computer Talk Radio? But today, technology and computers and all kinds of these different things are just intertwined into just about everything we experience with a car. So it's definitely right up our alley, all puns intended.
It is. I admittedly, I got that reaction in 2019, the first time I asked for a press pass to Apex and SEMA.
Yeah.
But I was able to denote that as an AT&T strategist, I worked on the connected car and created the first connected scooter, as well as all the data involved with the modern ADAS systems.
Yeah.
Adaptive safety systems that are in modern cars. But there wasn't as much content and vendors for technology, where now they even had a number of vendors to support business services in general, like shipping and logistics, search engine optimization, specialty for automotive. HR. So there are some specialty companies for the automotive sector, and there is actually a few of those. I didn't cover them in particular because I covered the specialty events. I did get one of the logistics providers.
Yeah.
But you can see them in the walkabout. In 19, they didn't have a data stage, where in the last couple of years, they actually have a data stage as well.
Very nice.
3D printing, you know, for replacement parts.
Yes.
Manufacturing.
Yes,
so
yes.
You get the 3D stereo complicated data for multidimensional imaging that you have to manipulate, the same as we had with the drone conference.
Yes.
It's the same kind of technology and science behind what they do for 3D printing of automotive parts.
Interesting. We're moving in a direction with technology that is just astounding. You know, I don't know that Henry Ford would have ever imagined what we would be doing with cars today.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, this event is massive. I think I was sharing with you, I had some, in 2 days, 30,000 steps at the event, over 500 stand hours.
Yeah.
There's 161,000 people with over 70,000 buyers. From a size perspective, it was over 1.2 million square feet of exhibits at the convention center alone.
Yeah, yeah.
Plus another million feet of exhibits outside and nearby, including Westgate.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It was huge.
Yes, yes, huge. Yes. Well, you've got to have more space for the cars. You know, at CES, you know, it's fun to see these massive, you see these massive booths for places like AMD or NVIDIA or Microsoft. But then outside in the parking lot, they've got a big, huge area of the parking lot set aside for Chevy or BMW or whoever. And it just absolutely dwarfs the whole idea of how big the Microsoft booth is. So SEMA, of course, you've got to have the room because, well, cars are slightly bigger than computers these days.
Not as big as the construction vehicles that come in March.
Yeah.
Next year's Con Expo. Yeah, it's an every 3 year event.
It's funny.
It's the only convention center that can hold these heavy multi-ton vehicles up on the floors in the convention center.
Yes,
the only convention center, at least in North America, maybe the world, that can actually put these vehicles in it, not just in the parking lot. And the parking lot will crumble either. So yeah, no, it's but cars definitely take up space, and they had over 2,400 exhibitors, 140 countries. I had the number of cars somewhere. I know it in my write-up, but it's not coming. It swapped out of my personal cash. 1,500 vehicles in the booth and surrounding everywhere. So everywhere, every hall, right? But the connection between West Hall and North Hall, they use it different ways. Mm-hmm. It was an art walk. So if you were looking for car art,
okay,
and you're an art enthusiast and you want car art for this, any type, all the artists rent space and they have all this car art.
That would be awesome for me. I love
it. Oh, yeah. Beautiful art. I have a video of it, so you can check it out, of course.
Very cool.
I also walked the outdoor parking lot with all the fancy doodads and everything. I walked all the halls. I mean, as technologists, the tires and wheels may not be of interest, but I walked it just as a point of principle.
Yeah.
So you can check it out. I will tell you, Caesars Forum is the least visually interesting. It's the heavy foreign ones and the kind of like rubber stamp, how they look. And so all the ones from one country look the same.
Sure. Yeah.
China.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was quieter too, because not a lot of buyers for China parts as much right now.
So what were some of the interesting exhibits that you saw there?
So the stars, the videos that are rising, is I caught Turntide's axial flux motor all-electric Sierra Echo S.
That's a mouthful.
You can go like 140 miles an hour to open top. And yeah, they liked it. I liked that it had flux in the name because it reminded me of Back to the Future. The
yes, yes, yes. Appropriate week, because November 5th is the date when he thinks of when he, you know, has his fall, bumps his head, and he thinks of the flux capacitor. So good timing.
But it was last week at Money when they actually had a Back to the Future with someone dressed up like that character in Expo Hall. So if you look at the video right when I walk into Expo Hall to the left, you can see it. I didn't want to go too close to anything that would cause a copyright issue or anything.
Sure, yeah.
You know, you had to be sensitive about that. But it's in there. So, but it's in the very beginning of the walkabout. And as you know, the walkabouts have its own separate playlist. Mm-hmm. But the other thing was something we caught at CES as well. It's from this Korean company that has this high res never fail dash cam because it's super low power.
Yeah.
And basically this company figured out that they had a silicon video capability for ridiculous 2K and 4K video capability and analysis and everything that could use very low power. And then they said, you know what, this dash cam would be a great use case, and created the dash cam.
Oh, nice.
They realized that their chip was state of the art for the exact requirements you need in that product category.
Okay.
And it automatically, they thought of privacy. So if you're in Europe and you have your dash cam, but you want to post your joyride on the internet, mm-hmm, it automatically buffers everyone's face for you, which would be very difficult for yourself to achieve. However, if someone rammed into you and took off and you want to make sure you find out what the license plate is and you couldn't maybe figure out what it was, there's also cloud solutions available as part of the product that you can clear the image of the license plate to find out who it was that hit your car and ran off or hit the pedestrian and took off and such.
Wow.
So it's kind of like two-folded capability. I thought was kind of interesting. So, we caught them at CES as well. So fun stuff. Fun stuff. And all kinds of lighting too.
For the cars. Totally. I mean, everybody. There's tons of lighting on cars.
Or any color paint or any color wrap you might like. And you know how it is. You like to tune. But there's also a product that had over 21,000 different models of cars because we're all geeks, right? Yeah. And a lot of geeks want to go into the ECU and tune it.
Yes.
Want to get into the car computer and tune it.
Yes.
So I found someone that had over 21,000 models they can get into.
Oh, wow. Who was that?
Auto-tune.
Auto-tune. Interesting. Okay.
Yep.
Which is as opposed to auto-tune, which is what all the singers use. I get it. So,
AT is their logo. I thought y'all would like that.
That is very cool. I've talked about doing that a number of years ago I've got a BMW.
And, nerds.
I
may or may not have a nerd kit for mine.
Very nice. Give out what people can find out about you.
TBW Advisors on YouTube or TBWAdvisors.com. That's T for technical, B for business, W for whispers, TBW Advisors.
This is Benjamin Rockwell.
And I'm Dr. Doreen Galley.
You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Micro Center, home to all kinds of electronics and computer items, has over 20 locations across the country, and it's also available at microcenter.com. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I live just a couple of miles away from my local Micro Center, and I've been shopping there for years. From Apple to Windows, they've got what you need. CPUs, got them. Screwdrivers and other tools, yep. Cables, televisions, scanners, projectors, cameras, they have it all. Micro Center is a place which fills your electronic needs. What are you looking for? Media centers, monitors, mice, MP3 players, media, modems, motherboards, memory? Those are just the M's. They aren't regional, but spread across our great land from Virginia to California. Each one is service and repair, in-store clinics, and business services, too. MicroCenter.com is their online store, a place where you can get your regular online ordering needs met. From the hobbyist to the professional, the brand name, or building it yourself, MicroCenter is your resource. Check out MicroCenter.com today. MicroCenter.com.
The phone number, 888-NERD-888. That's 888-637-3888. If I don't answer the phone, that's okay. Leave a message. I will get back to you. That phone number works 24/7, 365, because we do love answering your computer questions and your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Keith McClure joins me now. And Keith, what's the topic for this week?
Well, Benjamin, I think it is high time we talk about technologies that are going into the Mac in the future and contrasting them to their PC Windows brethren. And if you think about it, we have technology in the mobile device arena from Apple in the form of the iPhone, the iPad, and even the Apple Watch, where you touch the screen to interface with the system.
Operating system, yeah.
Sure. And what is interesting, because you know that my wife is a Windows user, for all the Apple technology she uses, her laptop is still a Windows PC running Microsoft Windows. And what I've found interesting is that a lot of the PC manufacturers make PCs, desktops, and laptops that have touchscreens. And yes. Apple has not done that yet. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because a number of industry analysts have started talking about this again. And this comes well over a decade after Steve Jobs had passed, because a couple of years before, he'd been asked in an interview, will Apple make a touchscreen Mac, either laptop and or desktop?
Yeah.
And he said, this is something we've, you know, prototyped and tested and experimented with. And the long and the short of it, to paraphrase him, was that there were a lot of pain points. Because unlike a mobile device, which is in your hand and might be resting and you're looking down, on a laptop or a desktop, you're always raising your arm. And that would lead to a lot of fatigue where, you know, you're interfacing with it by touching the screen directly.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I find myself at a bit of a crossroads between my use of my mobile devices from Apple and my Macs, in that when I'm on the Mac, I spend a great deal of time more on my Apple mobile devices, specifically my iPhone, and to a lesser degree, my iPad, that when I get on my Mac, because there are so many crossover points in the interface today, unlike when those devices were brand new, I find the impetus to actually touch the screen on my Mac to, you know, close a window, drag something, open something. I find those instances are growing, and I'm wondering if you think it would be beneficial if Apple actually did introduce a touchscreen component to the Mac.
So I will tell you, for my desktop, I don't have a touch screen there. For my laptops, they all have touch screens. My work laptop, my personal laptop, my Chromebook. I find that the touch screen for each of those is not a primary surface. However, it is an instinctive secondary surface, meaning I do use the keyboard. I do use the mouse or the touchpad or whatever it is. And I do interact mostly utilizing those. But there are times where, yes, I'm sitting on my laptop and, yeah, I'll poke at the closed window or I'll poke over at, you know, using my finger at the screen. To where I've got Excel or Word or Outlook, whatever it is. The age-old item back when Steve Jobs was turning it down, and actually before then, we had people kind of chuckling about, okay, why would we do a big, huge touch screen when we're going to have our hands, you know, waving about in the air? And the answer is, we're not really doing that. It serves as that instinctive surface to work with that augments the experience versus being the primary experience.
And when you say it like that, I actually agree, because long before Apple made mobile devices, we were quite content to interface with our desktops with a mouse, and to interface with our MacBooks and PowerBooks with a trackpad. And even back then, they were small, the trackpads. Mm-hmm. But today, you get a brand new MacBook today, and it's bigger than an index card. I mean, that trackpad's like 4x6. I mean, what I'd really love to see is maybe some type of Apple Pencil interaction on the trackpad. On, you know, instead of having
that would be interesting.
Instead of having to have a Wacom tablet plugged in one of your USB or Thunderbolt ports, why not have direct input for the Apple Pencil on that huge honking trackpad that they have on all the Mac laptops?
Sure, definitely. And as we start to move along, especially with like Apple Intelligence and moving a little bit more towards voice and a lot more towards voice, people are going to be, I don't want to say abandoning the keyboard and throwing the mouse to the side or, you know, the trackpad. I think it's only natural that they should be looking into the touchscreen as an additional interface, especially in situations like the desktops where, yeah, people can abandon the keyboard and mouse mostly. And the touchscreen is going to be a better place for that interaction.
Sure. And do you think that they would actually go with voice? Because, I mean, do you think it's there yet?
Do I think it's there yet? No. Do I think that this is a direction that everybody is looking? I know it's a direction everybody's looking in. A matter of they're stating across the board that the voice interface is eventually going to take over. Do I fully agree with that? No.
Yeah, because Steve Jobs once said that they see the voice interface as perpetually 5 years down the road.
Yeah, pretty much. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell.
And I'm Keith M. Cedor.
You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Hi, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Most of us use digital cameras nowadays, but what do we do with those old pictures and slides in the back of the closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. If you have boxes of old slides, then you know they fade more and more each year. Let Legacy Digital scan them for you and stop the aging process dead in its tracks. You'll get beautiful 10-megapixel digital files, color-corrected and ready for printing. All this is done faster and cheaper than buying a film scanner and doing it yourself. Your files are then burned onto gold archival DVD discs where they will last for generations. Call right now, mention my name, Benjamin Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY. And tell them Benjamin sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
Mark Brownstein joins me, and Mark, one of the things you just wrote down here, you just sent me a note, do we want smart everything? And I'm sitting here. I have an idea of where you're going with this, but go ahead, tell me, what brought this on? What brought this to your mind?
Actually, it came to mind a few months ago when one of the members of the Computer Press Association, which I belong to, came up with the same question. He did an article about smart products, and it triggered in my mind what we've got to do. It's smart, and AI have become buzzwords. Some of it's marketing. In theory, my shoes might be smart. They keep track of which step I take, my gait, who knows what. My watch does that, actually. It tells me if my balance is wrong. But for now, does it have to be smart to be able to sell it? There are so many things out there that claim they're smart.
Yeah.
I was thinking, just preparing this. Go ahead.
You know, I was commenting on this a little while back when Samsung, their smart fridges. Now, you're paying $1,800 to $3,500 for one of these smart fridges, and they're feeding us advertisements on this? I'm sorry, if I'm paying $2,000, $3,000, or more, I don't expect to get advertisements. But we're going in crazy directions.
We are. I have one of those refrigerators too. It's Wi-Fi. I never really use it except to tell my water to do water rather than crushed ice or ice.
Yeah.
I don't use any of the other stuff, but at least it doesn't have any ads in it. But I got this 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah.
I was thinking Wi-Fi and AI are two different things, and the marketing is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking when I was writing this up, do we really need a shower head with smarts? They don't make one yet.
Actually,
shower head.
All of a sudden it comes to mind. I think there is a system. For the people who really have way too much money, you can have it go ahead and adjust the temperature or something like that. No, I'm going to sit there and I'm going to adjust it. I don't know from day to day if I want a hot shower or a warm shower or a cold shower.
Well, I'm thinking this actually makes sense to me. You can tell it to stop or to lower the stream if you want to soap up, and then to turn it back up to higher pressure to rinse.
Yeah.
You can tell it what temperature you need.
Okay.
Tell it maybe to start and beep and announce when the temperature is where you want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you can give it the start, the smarts maybe to turn off when you want to walk out of the shower. And you might even be able to hook to Alexa or Google and play music and give you your daily agenda. So there are things where a shower head might actually be smart.
Okay.
There are a lot of things where a shower head really wouldn't. Now, I think Marty and I have the same faucet. I don't know if he's installed it. I know I haven't. It's Moen's, something that was made in 2020 or so. You can get temperature at a precise temperature and the precise flow, but if your water is not hot, it takes a long time to heat up. It's Wi-Fi connected. It's Google controlled. You can tell it to turn on. You can tell it how much water you want. You can also tap it to turn it on and off. But there are things, Wi-Fi will do it. I've got an Oral-B 40 toothbrush that uses Alexa. Play music.
I'm sorry. In a toothbrush that is Alexa enabled? Okay.
Well, the brush itself isn't. It's just a regularly powered brush, but you put it into the charger. The charger will play the Alexa stuff. It'll link to Alexa. It'll give you your schedule. It'll play music. It'll play whatever you want on the radio. It'll tell you what time it is.
Okay.
I don't think I would, but I got it and I'm using it to charge the toothbrush. And that's pretty much it. I brought it back from place where I stuck living during right after a flood. And I haven't connected it to the internet at all.
Yeah.
And I haven't missed it.
That kind of throws me. I will go back to the faucet because, okay, once in a while, I will make bread from scratch. And and for that, I go up to the, you've got to have the, warm water. It's got to be whatever it is, 110 or 112 degrees.
Yeah, 110.
Yeah.
You need a certain amount. This will measure out how much you need.
Yeah.
Those kinds of things are great. If you need 8 ounces, it'll give you 8 ounces. If you want 6 ounces, you'll get 6 ounces.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah, there are reasons you'd want that.
So, okay. I mean, that kind of it does okay. Any other smart items that you've come across? Anything that really makes you scratch your head?
I am using the Plod Note. I just got another smart device, and I'm trying to get the name. I've forgotten the name of it, but it does the same as the Plod Note.
Okay.
And these do a pretty good job. When you're done recording, they'll transfer it to the phone, and from the phone, they'll transfer it to AI, and AI does a pretty good job of transcription and summarizing. And, there's not always great translation, but it does a pretty good job. The other device is called a Nada. I call it Nada, not a memo. They call it Nota Memo.
Uh-huh.
And in addition to just recording, it also does real-time transcription.
Okay.
So you can actually look at what you're doing. It does real-time translation, which I haven't tried yet. So these are things that it looks like it might excel over the Plod, but I really don't know because they haven't done a whole lot with it. But for some things, AI actually works well.
Very cool. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Mark Brownstein. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and just a normal person. Recently, though, it was clear to me that it was time to upgrade, but I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After searching around for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their willingness to do things the right way. The site ground salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when a 32-ounce soda would do. These guys know WordPress, Joomla, and regular standard websites. These guys at SiteGround are awesome. SiteGround.com. Site, S-I-T-E, ground.com. The bad guys are out to get us. They're out to get you, me, and everybody they can. And what I'm going to give you is one of the tricks that, well, okay, I've talked about one trick for a number of years, this idea of using a passcode between you and your family. And this trick is kind of a spinoff on this. It is very similar to that same trick. Now, in the passcode thing, you've set up a challenge response kind of system. So you would have a word that you would use between each other. Think of it like a password that you use to get into your computer. This is a way to validate that the person on the other end is who they say they are. But this next trick, this new trick that I'm going to give you this week, is a little bit different in that what we're going to do is we're going to utilize something from the movie Terminator 2. And during Terminator 2, there was this sequence where John Connor, the kid, is talking with his foster mother. And the Terminator, played by Arnold Schwarzenegger, he goes and he takes the phone, and John is just suitably upset. He's like, my foster mom's normally not like this. This is kind of weird. She's all pleasant and kind. And so the Terminator goes, what's the dog's name? And John goes, Max. And the Terminator, who can impersonate anybody's voice, says, hey, Janelle, which is the foster mom's name, what's wrong with Wolfie? Mind you, the dog's name is Max, okay? I can hear him barking. And Janelle, the foster mom, goes, Wolfie's fine, honey. Wolfie's just fine. Where are you? And then the Terminator hangs up the phone and delivers the bad news that, yeah, something really is wrong. I want you to use that same kind of concept in this same way. You basically set up a question that seems rather mundane. It's something that somebody wouldn't guess. So you add in something that may or may not be a real factor in your lives. Hey, by the way, you know what? I'm down here at the store. What's the soap that you just recommended to me the other day? And that would be something that, you know, they'd go, what soap? The scammer is going to try to lie. They're going to try and get out of it. You know, you might ask, you know, where is the extra dog food? Or where did we put this? Where did we put that? You ask something that the person on the other end knows or maybe doesn't know. But I want you to ask for some really boring basics, something that's never going to be talked about on social media or discussed with others. You're going to ask something that is going to help you verify that who you're talking to on the other end of the phone is the real person. The person that you're expecting to be talking to, not some kind of deep fake. In this day and age, it's kind of unhappy and sad that we actually have to resort to tricks like this, but it's something that, for the sake of your relationships, you may need to also share this with the people in your life that you think you might have to do it with. Otherwise, this could go rather bad. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Let me tell you about the Radio Factory, an exciting new venue for talk radio. It's the internet, the wave of the present. My name is Benjamin Rockwell, and I'm the host of a syndicated radio program, Computer Talk Radio. So I know the internet is here and now. Many of the hosts at theradiofactory.com have their own podcasts or radio shows across the country. But many people like the comfort of listening to their own special radio show at a specific time and day, much like we watch live television. The internet, as you're probably aware, is a powerful tool that allows the Radio Factory to deliver unique programming with far more variety than the windbags who are simply about contriving up viewpoints to get you riled up. Additionally, you'll find that many of the programs are shorter, giving more information in less time. Stick with theradiofactory.com and see how it evolves to keep you entertained, interested, informed, and above all, intelligent. After all, the Radio Factory motto is building your intelligence one talk show at a time. TheRadioFactory.com.
Yeah, he's our favorite nerd. And now, with a quest of enriching your experience with computers, here's Benjamin Rockwell with Computer Talk Radio.
We are halfway through this week's Computer Talk Radio. Let me pause for a moment just to give out the website and the phone number for you. The website, it's appropriately named ComputerTalkRadio.com. ComputerTalkRadio.com. Of course, you can reach us there, listen there, leave us messages, whatever you want. You can also phone us at 888-NERD-888. That's 888-6373-888. If I don't answer the phone, that's okay. Leave a message. I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions, your technology concerns, whatever they may be. I love doing that. I love engaging with all of the listeners on all of the various topics they bring forth related to technology, of course. Steve Keske joins me now. And Steve, what do you have for us this week?
I heard about something the other day.
Yes.
That I don't know all that much about, but I probably know that you do.
Yes.
It's called a chatbot.
Yes. Okay. So for the audience to understand, Steve has been here. He's been in technology for...
over 50 years.
A long time. I wasn't going to name a number. Not like that one, but thank you. So he is legally blind, so he is not quite as familiar with... We've talked about AI. We have talked about artificial intelligence a number of times here on the show and how AI is moving forward. Now, AI is split into a number of different directions. And some of these get kind of hazy as to where they sit. OpenAI has something called ChatGPT. And that, by its own explanation there, it is part of its utilizing, rather, a large language model to chat with you. And that large language model, we may see that large language model used in other directions. Like if you do a Google search and you get a response that's AI generated, well, you're not chatting with it, but it's still providing a response in a way to your Google search utilizing that large language model. Now, if you go directly to, and there's a number of these. I don't want to just single out ChatGPT. That's one of the big names that everybody knows. You can go and you can sit down and you can have a conversation with it. And with this conversation, it utilizes a lot of information out there on the internet combined with what it knows and what it's able to deduce from whatever you asked. It is a much more advanced version, and Steve will get this right away. It's a much more advanced version of an old program that was, I first used it on a mainframe called Eliza.
Ooh, that is old.
Yes. So, Steve, you recall Eliza. It was a simple program that acted kind of like a therapist.
Yeah.
A very, very limited therapist where you would say, I'm feeling bad about what I said. And Eliza would say, well, tell me what you said. And then it would say on the next thing, so why do you feel bad about that? You notice it's referencing some of the different things, some of the different clues from what I've already said. So it's just kind of feeding that information back to you.
Right.
And
like most therapists do.
Well, yeah. So it's actually kind of interesting because, yes, we've evolved in a direction now where a lot of people are utilizing things like ChatGPT as a therapist, as something that is far more than they should expect. Yes, Eliza was a simple version, and ChatGPT is a more advanced version, but there's no feelings on the other side of that. There's no true
crazy
brain.
Of course you are.
So what had you heard about chatbots that made you want to bring this up?
Well, what I had heard was there were basically two different kinds. Those that you're talking about, that you can talk to and it replies to you and all that. And then there was another kind of chatbot that goes more in depth of what, because you talk to it over a period of time and it learns more about you, so it comes out more, you know, responsive to your specifics.
So yes, on all of these, there are differing capabilities, but they do track. I've used these for doing various work, filling out. You know, one of the things I did recently, I had an annual review, a self-evaluation, and I utilized that, a form of chatbot. I think it kind of delves into what is agentic AI, but I wasn't quite using it as a true agent. I said, hey, go on out, look at all of my emails in this particular folder from this date to this date, and develop, find all of the common threads in here, and help me develop a self-evaluation and produce this in this particular format. And it was able to pull this information from all of these different spots, both the email folder and the requirements and samples, and build this information. Now, one of the things that I did not do, which is, this is kind of a feeling of a lot of people, when we start utilizing AI to do our work for us, we tend to, we can have a tendency to be lazy. So I used this as a launch point in my personal case. And this is something that everybody listening should take away from this. I used this as the starting point. I used what was really an amazing framework, and I pulled out some of the things which I said, that's going to be going over the top. That's going to be something that really I shouldn't claim. And I tweaked it based off of what I knew about myself and the past year that I had spent the company. And this is something that everybody should be doing. You know, we hear about these college students,
yeah,
that have the AI write their term paper. No, that should be, at best, that should be
the framework.
A framework for your first draft. Sure. And you should go through a couple of more drafts. If you get stuck anywhere further in that, yes, go through. You can ask AI questions about it. How can I word this differently? How can I change this? But if you start seeing words you don't recognize, you're in over your head. If you see phrasing that is not your natural spoken way of saying things, you're in over your head.
Yeah,
and
you need to
translate it into your speak.
Well, when it comes out back and tells you, "Hey, dum-dum,"
usually it doesn't do that.
No, it doesn't. I remember back when I was doing computer directed courses.
Yeah.
And you had to read this stuff and then answer a bunch of questions. Mm-hmm. And this one guy came back and said, I don't like the computer. And I said, why? And he said, well, it kept telling me that I was dumb. And I'm saying, what question were you on? And it said, it gave me the question. And I said, what answer did you give it? I said, A, B, and C. And it told me I was wrong all the time. And I says, well, what did option D say? Oh, it said all of the above. And I'm saying, now you know why.
Yeah.
I mean, those are simple solutions to a very illogical thought process on the user's part.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I've seen this kind of stuff for many, many, many years.
Yeah.
And it's only getting to the point now where, sure, the machine does a whole lot for you, but you have to use it as a tool, not as a remedy.
Yes, and that is so very accurate, and it is something that everybody really needs to take that into consideration. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Steve Keske. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. You have a couple of those new carbon open frame racks from CyberPower, right?
Yeah, I love them. I configured a 25U to 40 inches deep, about twice as deep as a regular rack, and put more than a dozen peripherals in it.
You know, I saw your article about it. I can't believe it's not clutter.
And my 45U carbon rack, that's also 40 inches deep, will hold a ton of networking and control systems, the network video recorder.
Holy screwdriver, Rackman!
You're getting one of their gorgeous enclosed racks soon.
Oh yeah, the 24U. Bigger than their wall-mount carbon racks, but smaller than their tall boy.
Did you see what's happening with carbon on the CyberPower website?
Oh yeah, the promo, 10% off all their racks and rack accessories through the end of September. I put a link up at computertalkradio.com. ComputerTalkRadio.com. Erin called me up with a great question. She asked, why does the performance of my video conference call degrade even though I have good resources? And Erin reached out to me at 888-NERD. 888. That's 888-637-3888. By the way, if I don't answer the phone, that's okay. Leave a message. I will get back to you just as soon as I have a free moment. We're interested in answering all of your computer questions and your technology concerns. Now, in Erin's case, the performance of video calls degrading even though she feels she has great resources on her PC. And look, I get this. There are so many different areas to look at. As a matter of fact, this is going to be a laundry list of different things you might look at. Hopefully, though, I want to present this as something that different areas for you to look at for whatever tech issues you might be coming across where they might, you know, video might be slowing down or whatever. And I get this. So it's really like having a nice kitchen. But a lot of the things that are going to be covered here have to do with overcrowding it. You're getting like five people in your kitchen and everybody's bumping elbows and they're slowing each other down. And this really applies to video conference calls. It applies to video streaming. At times it can apply to gaming and all of the rest, because all of these occupy a lot of different sets of what I'm going to cover here. First up, we have to look at the PC itself, and we may have a variety of active applications that are going. At any given point in time, I usually have Word and Excel and Outlook and browsers open, multiple browsers with multiple tabs, and each of these are going to be competing for network bandwidth, for CPU usage, memory as well. And all of these are sitting on my system. Now, I do have a number of different things that are going in my favor because I do have a lot of resources here. But at times, we think we have enough resources. We think we have enough RAM. And if we don't have enough RAM, yeah, it's going to swap it down to the hard drive. We may think we have a fast enough hard drive. But if we're working with an older hard drive and not solid state drives, that can be an issue. Same thing with a CPU. But those are usually the first things we look at. That's what Aaron looked at. Now we start to look at some of these other things that are in here. Because just because you have these apps open doesn't mean that there aren't more applications going on. Whether we're talking about your Dropbox or Google Drive or Microsoft's cloud systems or whatever. All of these are competing for network resources. Your system may be downloading updates, and this may be network. It also may be CPU usage that it's going to be spiking up. But let's move beyond that. In my home, we have multiple systems. My wife and I both have multiple computers. We've got a number of televisions in the house which can stream video. So we don't worry about that too much in our home because, okay, so we've got high speed. We've got fiber internet, gig up, gig down. Great, beautiful stuff. But for many people, you get enough people on the network that are trying to do high bandwidth items. And that is going to take away from what your available internet speed is. It just takes a few people on watching Netflix, for instance. And maybe if my wife and I were both on video calls and we're also updating systems and so forth, like I mentioned before, this can all seriously eat up everything we've got going on in regards to our internet bandwidth. And that's just that. That's a set of two bottlenecks, your local PC and then your internet speed. And that is the next bottleneck. Now, there's other bottlenecks that can all combine into this that can impact just one stream. For instance, so the video goes from my system through the internet, goes on out through my internet service provider. And if they're having problems, that can cause a degradation in the video call. But it goes across the internet. It goes to the other person's internet service provider that could have problems. Their internet connection may be a slow connection. Their system may be having a problem. And the way video conferencing works is it seeks to keep the call alive as best it can. And that's how we get into a situation where, yes, it may say we can't maintain that full bandwidth, so we're going to bump down the video quality on both ends, and sometimes even the audio quality. And it adapts. It's constantly working throughout the entire call to maintain the full connectivity at whatever cost it can to video or audio. So this is something that can kind of mess things up. We also have things in our routers. Your router at your home, your internet router, may have quality of service settings. You'll see this as QoS if you're digging around. And that may prioritize, or actually deprioritize, your video traffic. That can throw you off as well. Then we start getting into ideas like old networks, network hardware and routers and things like that. And they may not be able to handle the multiple streams that are going on as well as all of the other traffic that's going on in your house. All of this just starts to eat into different things here. And I never mentioned the conferencing service itself may be having server issues or regional latency issues or things like that. And then we also need to enter into the thought that sometimes if we're talking about work video conferencing, you know, some companies have really good video conferencing servers in-house, but at a certain point, too many of the employees are doing video conferencing at once, and that is going to start degrading all of the video. And yes, people sharing screens, that's going to consume not only the bandwidth, but also some of the CPU and GPU resources. And this is also going to start increasing that processing demand. That can throw you off. Then we start going into other directions. Virtual private networks, security software, they may be going through the traffic and inspecting it and checking things out, and that adds in a delay. All of these things kind of combine up, and they can create kind of this big, huge disaster. Now, one of the things that you can always do, if you have this on a regular basis, you know, look at those. If it's a one-time shot, and or it's infrequent, I will tell you one of the things that Keith and I do on a regular basis. When we're setting up and we're getting ready to record, he and I talk for a matter of an hour or two every week. Yes, you only hear us for just a short little while, but we talk for a lot more. And one of the things we may notice is, hey, we've got poor video quality tonight. And what we do is the two of us simply reboot our own systems. Him on his side, me on my side, and that frequently will resolve all of those issues. It's both just a resetting of the computer, but it's also a resetting of the connection between us. And that is something that is very valuable. It's a great trick that we've talked about on a number of occasions. If everything's going wrong, if everything's just going weird, or even if it's just one thing that you're noticing, turning it off and turning it back on may actually just resolve all of those different issues. Look, there's a number of different directions we can go in with all kinds of different issues. And it pays to really research things, discuss them around, and figure out what it could be. Now, in Erin's case, we did talk this through, and we found out, actually, she was running on an older system with a bit less RAM, and she had a little bit too much in the way of applications that she was running while she was trying to do video. And all of that kind of mounted on up. Your situation might be different, so feel free to look at all of these different things and to think about the fact that it may not just be your computer, but all of these different interlinking components that bring the marvel of us being able to speak face to face hundreds or thousands of miles away. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Micro Center, home to all kinds of electronics and computer items, has over 20 locations across the country, and it's also available at microcenter.com. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I live just a couple of miles away from my local Micro Center, and I've been shopping there for years. From Apple to Windows, they've got what you need. CPUs, got them. Screwdrivers and other tools, yep. Cables, televisions, scanners, projectors, cameras, they have it all. Micro Center is a place which fills your electronic needs. What are you looking for? Media centers, monitors, mice, MP3 players, media, modems, motherboards, memory? Those are just the M's. They aren't regional, but spread across our great land from Virginia to California. Each one is service and repair, in-store clinics, and business services, too. Microcenter.com is their online store, a place where you can get your regular online ordering needs met. From the hobbyist to the professional, the brand name, or building it yourself, Microcenter is your resource. Check out Microcenter.com today. Microcenter.com.
Lily had a question. How worried should I be about data breaches from retailers and loyalty programs? And Lily reached out to me. You can do it too. Phone me at 888-NERD-888. That's 888-633-8888. I will answer your computer questions, your technology concerns. If I don't answer the phone, that's okay. Leave a message. I will get back to you. So Lily had concerns about data breaches from retailers, from loyalty programs, from all of these different locations. And look, I know what it's like. We're all concerned about this. And we have to trust a store to safeguard our information. And we do hear about this kind of information loss on a regular basis. And it's getting to a point where the news cycle plays this up. Oh, hey, so-and-so got broken into. And we find out, okay, yeah, they got broken into, but all they got were a bunch of usernames and passwords. Okay, that's still a problem. Or they got the username and zip code. Well, okay, yeah, that's not as big of a problem on the face of it, but it can be a matter of a partial leak leading to a phishing attempt or identity theft, especially when we have a lot of these partial leaks that are happening. And these partial leaks, even if they only get a small amount of information in this one and a small amount of information in another one and a small amount of information in another one, there are guys in the hacking world that are going through and building databases. I mean, for as smart as they are, for the abilities they've got, they're using it in very unfortunate ways that can impact us. So they take the data from a number of breaches and merge that data together to come up with a lot more information that can be used against us. Now we start looking at, okay, whether it's a retailer with their loyalty programs. I keep saying that because that's the notes that I made. But it can be a matter of just you logging into whatever sales website there is. And I don't want to call out Best Buy or Amazon or Micro Center because I don't want to point to them individually. It can be just as easily be Target or Walmart or Costco or whoever. It doesn't matter. But all of these different data breaches that happen have issues which expose our details, our information out there. Unfortunately, we also have situations where retailers are sharing their data, and they're sharing their data with third-party analytics companies, marketing vendors, and that actually is also leading to not so much a direct data breach, but an ability for the bad guys to go further. And I don't want to scare you. I don't want to bring this up as a big, huge thing, but we need to be aware of it. So all of these different systems that are out there that are storing our data are leaving all of us open to some level of attack. That means we have to take our own actions. We have to take the precautions that will wind up protecting us. What does that mean? Well, I am a proponent for multi-factor authentication. We used to call it two-factor authentication. A matter of where you go on to a website, it basically says, okay, hey, log in. Okay, now that you're in the login process, we're going to send you a text message, and then you just need to key in that 6-digit, 7-digit, 8-digit number, or send us the word or whatever. And it actually verifies, as best it can, that we are who we say we are. And that kind of starts to help. And another thing I want us to all be doing is thinking about our password usage. And our password usage should always be a different password for each different website, each different system that we're logging into. We need to be taking part ourselves in protecting our data so we don't become victims. Another issue I've been a proponent of for a very long time is the idea of going out and making sure that when you're being asked questions that really don't have a bearing on the relationship with any whoever it is you're dealing with, that you don't answer quite as accurately as you should. What was your favorite car? Who is your favorite teacher? Who is your favorite whatever? And the answers that I provide usually for that will stick to some information that I actually know now. I used to write it in a book. I don't need to anymore. I have different answers. What my favorite movie is not what I enter onto the internet. My favorite movie is something completely different than what anybody will ever find out about me on the internet. And that's because I use not fake movies, but a different movie in choice. Same thing with what was my first car. And I put in something completely different. Whatever it is, you've just answered something different. But that kind of setup can start to protect you because they can't use that information against you. I do want to suggest there are monitoring services out there that can tell about your information out on the internet. Have I been pwned? P-W-N-E-D is one particular research site that you can use that will allow you to look up and see if your information is out on the internet, to see if you need to be making some changes and all of that. So we do need to think about all of these different aspects. We need to take efforts to guard any key data and any access to that data. And as we do this, as we learn to be better about this for ourselves, the risks to us as individuals will become far more manageable. It'll be far more of a situation where we can take those actions to protect ourselves from these data breaches. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Hey guys, this is Benny Rockwell. Most of us use video cameras nowadays, but what about those old movie films in the back of your closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. Imagine Grandpa's old 8mm and 16mm films that are just sitting in a box getting old and fading away. Legacy Digital will clean and recondition those films, capture them digitally frame by frame, and then produce beautiful DVDs of your precious memories on long-lasting archive-quality discs. They don't use a projector, and your films can't be damaged in the process, the best available for families like yours. The final results are gorgeous. What better way to preserve those precious memories for future generations? Call right now, mention my name, Benny Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY, 1-866-253-4229. And tell them Benny sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and so much more. Randy wrote in, I keep seeing stories about people landing six-figure tech jobs right out of school or worse, with no real job experience at all. How is that even possible? Why would any company pay someone over $100,000 when they've never proven themselves in the workplace? And that is... That's a big question. That is a very valid question. And I do get it. It does feel like watching someone jump straight to the major leagues without even playing in the minors. And experience used to be the ticket in. And for some roles, it seems like potential is the new currency. Before we scoff at the idea, I want to look at why this is happening and if this maybe even makes some sense here. So there are companies out there that are hiring inexperienced people at very high pay scales. And part of this comes with the scarcity of specialized skills. All right, so we're talking about things like AI and cybersecurity and data science and cloud architecture. There just simply aren't enough qualified professionals in those fields. So they start looking for someone who demonstrates deep technical skill that may come through self-taught projects or open source contributions. And companies often value that more than years spent in cubicles. And yes, there that is all about a portfolio that's being built up, and it's not so much pedigree. The idea of somebody who has been on GitHub and they've got a repository that has a bunch of solid code, or they've got a side project that solves a real world problem, and that carries a lot of weight with it. It demonstrates a certain set of skills that are needed. Showing you can do it often matters more than showing that you've done it. Now, there are some companies who prefer new talent because they're unshaped by, this is the way we've always done it. And that is also a very valuable thing, those fresh perspectives. And that actually may turn around into actually a cheaper salary point than the $500,000 salary. And it's a lesser risk. And yes, a $100,000 salary sounds really high. But for Silicon Valley or top tech markets, that's entry level for some of these specialties. So yes, all of these companies, they're going out there and they're testing potential. And they don't care about tenure. Many firms use technical interviews, simulations, coding challenges, all of this to gauge the ability of the person who's coming forward, eliminating some of that need for a long work history. I'll tell you, the field of AI is only a few years old. Cybersecurity changes at the drop of a hat. Every 6 months, we're seeing all kinds of new stuff there. Data science, and the way we're looking at this right now, that's a very new field as well. Cloud architecture, you're not going to find somebody who has 30 years of experience with cloud architecture because, yes, the internet is just about 30 years old. So, you know, you start really thinking about this. The idea of cloud architecture hasn't come around until far more recently. So you've got to look at how they're performing. And if they perform at a senior level, then they get paid at a senior level, even if their resume doesn't look like it should. Now, there are a few things where, and I get this, it doesn't sit right for some of us. Experience brings context, not just skill. Knowing how to code isn't the same as knowing how to work with clients, with teams, with deadlines. And there is value in having been burned by bad deployments or learning from real-world mistakes, lessons that aren't going to be taught in any kind of a boot camp or even in college courses or any of that. And then we start moving into the idea of entitlement risk. There's this concern that's been floating around through the tech industry. Throwing huge salaries at the untested really will start to create inflated expectations, and it weakens respect for those who are in the grind and have been for a long time. So when these juniors come along and they're out earning some of the professionals, there can be some resentment and instability within the teams. And all the way along, this really gets uncomfortable for a lot of people. I will tell you, book smarts do not equal street smarts. Anybody who's studied a book hasn't really dealt with the reality of the workplace. Tech isn't just about writing code. It's about problem solving under really messy human conditions. You do need to, in all of these workplaces, have a balance. I have said this many times, but those older IT workers, they have seen all of the things that can go wrong, or at least a lot of those things that can go wrong. I would suggest in any environment where you have these guys coming in that are green and they've never actually worked in a work environment, pair them up with a mentor that has been in IT for a long time. Yes, that can be a matter of somebody who is a manager or director, or yes, it can be in some situations, just somebody who's been there and maybe is just comfortable with the idea of IT and just being the day-to-day mentor and coming alongside of those new guys. There's a lot there to unpack. I don't have a whole lot of time for this, but I hope this helps unpack some of that. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and, well, a normal person. Recently, though, it became clear to me that it was time to upgrade. I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After looking for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their care, their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when all I needed was a 1-gallon bucket. The folks at SiteGround know WordPress, Joomla, and more. SiteGround.com, S-I-T-E, ground.com for your web hosting needs. SiteGround. Sylvina reached out to me. She ran into a very interesting problem, and essentially what she did was she upgraded the RAM in her computer, and she had a software license key. One of the software packages that she had installed on her computer all of a sudden just said, oh, this isn't a licensed computer. And she was confused by that, and she had to contact customer support, but they weren't really clear on why this happened. She had to provide a bunch of information, jump through hoops and all of that. So I'm going to explain one of the things that has floated around for a long time in various software packages. And what this is they take this entire digital snapshot of the hardware of the computer, and they interpret this into a series of numbers that, when fit with the validation key, the software license key, enables you to move forward. And some of them are better than others. Some of them allow for some level of adaptation, like adding RAM or a new hard drive or something like that. But what they're doing is they're checking all of these different statistics that are in your computer. This is kind of how different companies are able to identify your computer wherever you go around the world. You've got a laptop, and it looks at a number of different key features of how much memory you've got, but how many programs and what programs you have, and what version of the operating system, and what patch levels, and all of these different things start mounting up, and they go, yes, that's the fingerprint of Benjamin Rockwell right there. That's his laptop. It's not his desktop. It's not his work laptop. It is his personal Mac laptop, or his Chromebook, or whatever it is, and they put all of these things together in this way so that they can track us. Again, in the software realm, they're using that same kind of identification so that they can make sure that you're not installing that software on another computer. And yes, they have a lot of different things along the way. Sometimes it's just tied to specific hardware IDs. Sometimes it's tied to a file. Sometimes it's tied to a hidden file that's buried away that you'll never see, but it still exists. And there are all kinds of different clone tools, backup tools that people will use that, when they're upgrading their system or they're moving to a new, a brand new system, that even though you think you're copying over everything, the software, the company that you got the software from, they're looking at it and they're going, this isn't the same computer. Is this a violation? So what they're doing is they're having you reach out, contact them, and then they get to go through the validation efforts to make sure that you aren't violating the agreement, that you are really you and you're not going on out there and sharing your software with a whole bunch of people. And we usually see this in a lot of the higher end software packages where you're paying thousands of dollars. You're not going to see this on Microsoft Office or anything like that. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. We'll catch you next week.
Let me tell you about The Radio Factory, an exciting new venue for talk radio. It's the internet, the wave of the present. My name is Benjamin Rockwell, and I'm the host of a syndicated radio program, Computer Talk Radio. So I know the internet is here and now. Many of the hosts at theradiofactory.com have their own podcasts or radio shows across the country. But many people like the comfort of listening to their own special radio show at a specific time and day, much like we watch live television. The internet, as you're probably aware, is a powerful tool that allows The Radio Factory to deliver unique programming with far more variety than the windbags who are simply about contriving up viewpoints to get you riled up. Additionally, you'll find that many of the programs are shorter, giving more information in less time. Stick with theradiofactory.com and see how it evolves to keep you entertained, interested, informed, and above all, intelligent. After all, the Radio Factory motto is building your intelligence one talk show at a time. Theradiofactory.com.